Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Darren Aronofsky's 2006 film, The Fountain. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Dude, just partying on the edge of the Hollywood sign.
Man, I wish that was possible. Apparently, the city of Hollywood blocked it off to public access years and years ago after vandals changed the two O's to two E's, so it said Hollyweed, and the city of Hollywood was not too thrilled about that. But apparently, you used to literally be able to walk up and just touch the sign, which must have been pretty cool. I don't know how you got up. What's that?
Just jump the fence, man.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people have done that too. I've heard some stories, but anyway, if you guys are just joining us for the very first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish up with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. Tyler, I believe it's your turn for the character name game this week.
Oh, today's character name game is Melissa Robinson.
Ooh, that's so generic. That could be
Melissa Robinson.
Okay.
Middle name actually is generic, so you're on the right track.
Nice. We will return to that at the very end of the episode. We have another game that we've been playing recently called In My Netflix. So, Tyler, you have a selection for In My Netflix also?
Oh, yeah. Ben, you're going to be – let's start that cue music.
All right.
All right. Welcome to Up My Cue. With our guest today, Ben Pearson of NotJustNewMovies.com fame. How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing very well, sir. Thank you.
And what do you do for a living?
I can't really say. It's kind of secretive.
All right. Secret agent. I like it. I don't know why you're appearing. Your cover's blown. So let's get started here. Round one, okay?
Yep.
Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you two movies. One of them is in my Netflix queue. The other, regrettably, is not.
Okay.
And you have to choose the one that is in my Netflix queue based on, of course, what little you know about me.
Right, let's do it.
All right, round one. Which is in my queue? Kung Fu Hustle or Gregory's Girl?
I've never heard of, I'm traditionally horrible at this game. I've never heard of Gregory's Girl, and I'm pretty sure I saw Kung Fu Hustle in theaters with you when we were living in the same state, so I'm going to say Kung Fu Hustle again.
Oh, Ben, that is incorrect. It's actually Gregory's Girl.
What is
a random movie I selected for my queue. I don't think I've ever seen Kung Fu Hustle. You place me in your flashbacks way too often.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
Gregory's Girl, 1981. Awkward teenager Gregory, who lives in a small Scottish town, has started to discover girls. He becomes particularly infatuated with Dorothy because she manages to get onto the football team and is a better player than he is.
Okay.
Antics ensue. All
right.
So you didn't get the 16 points that were allotted for that round. Sorry.
That's all right.
So we're going to move on to round two. Hopefully we can do a little better with these two movies. Which one is in my queue? Gentleman Bronco or Space Cases Season 2?
Curse you.
Shout out to Jared, who loves Space Cases.
Man.
Who didn't love Space Cases.
Your selections are so ridiculous. I can't believe that you would have watched the entire first season of Space Cases without mentioning it before, so I'm going to go Gentleman Bronco.
Oh, ding, ding. That's correct.
All right.
All right, Gentleman Bronco, 2009. Hoping that his novel brings him fame and fortune, high school loner Benjamin Purvis attends a fantasy writers conference and later discovers that his masterwork has been plagiarized by an iconic author, Jermaine Clement, Flight of the Condors.
Concords, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Concords.
Yes.
whatever.
I remember that.
You got that.
I didn't see it, but I heard mixed
things. Space Cases Season 2. I don't think you have to have watched the first season to have them in your queue, correct?
No, you don't, but I just, you know, it, a normal sense would dictate.
I wonder if it's even on DVD.
I don't know.
It isn't. There's nothing in here on Netflix. Okay. So you got round two. You got 31 points. Congratulations.
All right, thanks.
Let's move on to a slightly difficult round three.
Oh, God.
Are you keeping up? Are you keeping up, Ben?
I am. Let's do it.
All right. These two movies, which one is in my queue? Cool Runnings or Cool World?
Wow. Man, that is awesome. I'm going to say Cool World because Cool World is in my queue.
Shit. Yes, you're correct. Cool awesome. World with Brad Pitt and some, you know, two-dimensional cartoon place.
Yeah, I think it's like the voice of Kim Basinger or something.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly. 1992. Wow. That's
a
cool one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool Runnings isn't in my queue. I've seen that plenty of times.
Right.
All
right.
So you got a total of 99 points that round.
Okay. All right.
Yes, you're almost at the 100 mark where you get a prize.
All right, let's do it.
All right, round four, the final round. Charade or Return to Oz? Hint, Cary Grant's in Charade. Cary Grant. Joe Day.
Return to Oz, man. Charade is actually in my queue also, strangely enough.
Why don't you queue stalk me a little more, dude?
I know, I don't think that's possible on Netflix, but I'm gonna go Return to Oz. I'm feeling saucy on that one.
Ding, ding, ding! That's correct. Return to Oz. 1985. Dorothy hasn't been the same since she came back from Oz, so a worried Aunt Em sends her niece to a clinic to begin shock therapy. But in the midst of an experiment, Dorothy returns to an unfamiliar land where the yellow brick road lies in ruins.
Wow, that sounds kind of cool, actually.
It's awful. I've seen it. It's bad.
Oof. All right.
But if you want to watch it, feel free, because I'm going to.
Okay. Right.
But yes. Yeah, good job. You broke the 100-point mark. I don't think you've ever done that.
Yeah, no. That was maybe a career best as far as in my Netflix goes.
But... You get an inoperative DVD copy of... Nemo's Trip in Slumberland.
Which you could find a review of that at notjustnewmovies.com, actually.
Yes, you can.
Oh, man, that's ridiculous. Okay, cool. Well, thanks for putting that together. Let's go ahead and go on into our media consume section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching or any sort of cool events that we've been to or anything. Tyler, I mean...
I'm tired of talking.
What? Oh, you want me to go first? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so two things I wanted to mention... Number one is a movie called The 39 Steps. This was a 1935 film directed by Alfred Hitchcock. I know.
Wait, 35?
Yeah, 1935. It's a British thriller directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Uh-huh. And it's been in my queue for a long time because I've been wanting to kind of expand my Hitchcock horizons a little bit. You know, I've seen most of his classic movies, but that's about it. And this one is not necessarily... you know, a very talked about Hitchcock film. So I just wanted to kind of give it a shot and see what some of his earlier work looked like. And this movie was actually kind of cool. It's a pretty interesting story. Like in the first 5 minutes, the main character, Richard Hanney, was played by a guy named Robert Donat. I think that's how you pronounce his name. It's probably pronounced with some sort of pronunciation difference there. D-O-N-A-T. But, Donat, maybe, I don't know. But he is just like a random Canadian dude in London and who lives there, and he's going to attend this like performance from a guy named Mr. Memory, who's this dude who has like a photographic memory, and he just kind of performs random feats in front of people, and people in crowds yell out questions for him to answer because he's just memorized, you know, seemingly everything or little pieces of trivia and stuff. So he's at this event, and somebody shoots, like just shots are fired in the crowd and like people sprint out and everything. And he meets this woman in the chaos, and she like asks him to, if she can go and kind of hide out at his apartment with him. And she says she's the one who fired the shots, and she is being chased by these assassin guys, and she's a spy, and she has found out this information about the 39 steps, which is like this kind of secretive thing. And like all this happens within the first like 10 minutes of the movie, so that's not really a spoiler thing. And then even like maybe 1 minute after that, she dies, she gets murdered, and then the assassins are now chasing after the guy. So it's really this kind of, you know, it's like it's kind of one of those traditional murder stories where it's like the, you know, just a guy, like a hapless man, kind of luck gets unlucky by stumbling into the wrong place at the wrong time type of thing. So he is like on a quest to discover what the 39 steps are, and all the while trying to evade these assassins that are after him. So it was a pretty cool story, and you know, it's fairly interesting. It's a short movie. It's only 86 minutes. So it's on Netflix Instant right now. I would recommend checking it out if you're, you know, like me, kind of looking for other examples of Hitchcock's work that aren't, you know, Vertigo and Psycho and all the really classic stuff. So it had some good performances in it. And it also had this kind of storyline where he gets hooked up with a woman later on in the story who clearly doesn't want anything to do with him. He tries to explain his situation. She doesn't believe him. She calls the cops, and like they end up getting handcuffed together and kind of have to escape from these assassins again. Like they're just kind of perpetually chasing them. And it's one of those kind of, you know, they're together in like a really traumatic situation. So they kind of fall in love, and they're like, you know, opposites, and they attract and all that kind of stuff. It's like, it's really, you know, stuff that's kind of a, what is that movie that,
freaking Days of the Condor?
No, Clark Gable was in, It Happened One Night, I think. It's like, that's the kind of movie that really brought that whole notion of like that romantic comedy, formula together in that way, you know, 'cause a lot of romantic comedies these days are just variations on that, you know, like,
Best Picture 1934.
Yeah, two people who were
Claudette Colbert.
Yeah, exactly. So two people who were like you know, just diametrically opposed in viewpoints,
yeah,
or whatever,
hate each other, right,
being thrown into a random situation and then coming out of it in love on the other side. So there, it had like a couple of those themes and kind of plot points and stuff thrown in there. So anyway, I thought the movie was pretty decent. It's definitely worth watching because it's so short and because it's got some good performances in it. So check it out. It's not like the most thrilling thing ever, but it's well done, especially for a movie in 1935. Like, are you kidding me? They were making movies in 1935, you know? Like, that's, yeah. So
I hope you're seriously asking that question.
No, I'm not. I'm just
as a film student.
I'm not, but I'm you know, a lot of times you look at movies that were made back then, and it's just completely like almost unwatchable because the language, like film language and structure, and a lot of these what is now, yeah, exactly, like different styles and stuff, and what is now commonplace was just like still being fleshed out and worked out and kind of coming into existence back then. So it's really hard to watch some of those older movies that just don't adhere to the same, you know, narrative structures and stuff that we're used to. But this one is definitely kind of in keeping with a movie that you would watch today. That was what I'm trying to get at. So
it sounds a little bit like North by Northwest.
It kind of is.
I wonder if that's a remake or some type of remake.
Let's see.
I don't know.
It says, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page right now, and it just says, 39 Steps is the second film in a line of Hitchcock films based upon the idea of an innocent man on the run, which also includes a movie called Saboteur from 1942 and North by Northwest in 1959.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. All right. Well, okay, so the other thing that I wanted to talk about is Tron Legacy. I actually rewatched Tron Legacy last night. Pat, my roommate, bought the Blu-ray, and we checked that out. What were your thoughts on Tron Legacy, Tyler? Remind me.
Tron Legacy? Mm-hmm. I think I mirrored your thoughts, where they could have gone a lot deeper with it. Mm-hmm. And the way we watch Tron, we have like conflicting, not really conflicting, but we have double reviews on the same movie
mm-hmm.
on the site. And I took mine like a little religious. It's like a religious experience mm-hmm. while you're in the computer world. And this movie, they didn't really break any new ground. I mean, visually, yes. But as far as like story and like meaning and, you know, kind of this, I mean, they tried it. They attempted to do it, but they didn't really succeed.
Yeah.
As far as like, you know, life creating life and
yeah,
blah 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 stuff yeah. like this. Who is the creator?
Yeah,
and you know, worlds that are created by higher beings, whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were trying to get to that, but I don't think they did with Tron Legacy.
Yeah, I like those were, you know, kind of criticisms that I had of it the first time I saw it, and they become even more kind of glaringly obvious on, you know, another go around, because it really does, like, the world of Tron is such a kind of great opportunity to explore all those themes in a really interesting way, and they really kind of drop the ball, I think, in Tron Legacy with that. Visually, it looks great. There are some cool action scenes and stuff, but even the action isn't really that awesome. Like, I was talking about this with Mazer from Geek Tyrant recently, and we were saying, like, there's not really an iconic scene in Tron Legacy that you would throw it on just to watch that scene. I was kind of making reference to the Matrix sequels, and even in the Matrix sequels, which aren't great films at all, there's that highway chase scene in the second movie that if that is on TV, I will stop and watch that entire sequence because it is freaking awesome. In Tron Legacy, there's not, like, even the disc battles and some of the motorcycle, like the light cycle stuff, there's nothing really there that is enough to make me stop what I'm doing and drop everything and watch it. You know, it looks cool visually all the way through, but there really isn't, like, an iconic scene that comes out of it, I think. And then like exactly what you were saying earlier, like, they really kind of didn't get to all of the deeper meaning stuff that they could have gotten to with this movie. Like, they keep making reference to, the grid, it could change everything we know about medicine, religion, science, all this stuff. But they just throw phrases around like that and don't ever prove or show us how it could change everything we know about philosophy and all these things. You know, it just kind of says that it can and doesn't back it up with anything. So the ISOs, which are the kind of life that came from nowhere because the circumstances were correct in the grid at the time, are referenced as these kind of holy beings almost, where they have this power to change the real world as we know it. But we don't know what the practical applications of that are. They never get into that in Tron Legacy. So I think that they were shooting for these kinds of, like, overarching ideals and stuff, and just kind of missed the basic element of showing us how that's even possible. So
it might just be a buffer movie between old Tron and what they want to do and maybe the third installment.
And that was the thing that Pat was saying, both when we watched it the first time and the other night when we watched it, and that, like, it's a really great setup movie. And I agree, like, you know, which they're already talking about doing a sequel to Tron Legacy and stuff, and they're working on an animated series that's going to be on Disney that's actually going to be kind of a prequel where it's going to bridge the gap between Tron and Tron Legacy. But obviously the sequels
try to piggyback on the Clone Wars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's really what it reminds me of. And the voice talent is really great. It's like Elijah Wood, Emmanuel Shariki, Mandy Moore. It's supposed to be pretty cool. But a sequel to Tron Legacy would, yeah, in theory, be pretty cool because they've spent a lot of time setting up the world and everything. But the kind of comeback that I had to that was, I think the movie should stand on its own as a good movie and also have those elements of setup in there. Like, I don't think as a movie company, as Disney or Warner Brothers or whatever, you can justify making an entire movie that's just set up to something else, because you have to have it, like, be good, I think. Like, I mean, that's the goal, right? It should be, anyway. And
I don't know, man. Jungle Book.
It just seems like just blatant franchising when a movie is pure setup and doesn't have enough to kind of hold on its own. So I don't know. That's like a kind of rambling thoughts on Tron Legacy. You can actually go to notjustnewmovies.com and read my review of it there. I think as it stands right now, that's like the most popular post in the history of my site. So whatever. Let's go to you, Tyler. What have you been what have you been consuming this week?
Recently, I mentioned this last week, I bought like 10 old games that I've been trying to play.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Indiana Jones. like the complete adventures.
Okay.
It has 28 levels, and each level is one of the adventures from the movies. So like the first couple are Raiders of the Lost Ark, and then Temple of Doom, mm-hmm. and then Last Crusade. And I can't get past the first level.
Really?
So, yeah. I passed the first level, and then you have to run away from the rolling boulder.
Yeah.
And this thing is huge, and if it touches you, you die.
Yeah.
But you don't see what's in front of you, so there's like traps getting thrown.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like running, and I've never played the game before. So I'm running, and I'm just dying in the traps, or I'm getting rolled over, and I just can't get past that hurdle.
Wow.
So that one's pretty difficult. And then there was another one, Daedalus Opus, which I predicted would be like Tetris, and I was half right, because you get the shapes, the little blocks like Tetris, but you have to fill in a space. So you get like all these puzzle pieces, and you have to like basically fill up the puzzle,
mm-hmm.
although it's not a puzzle game, it's just blocks. And it has really annoying music. The only really shining part is trying to figure out how to put the blocks into place.
Mm-hmm.
They don't tell you which buttons make the blocks do certain things, so I had to figure that out.
Okay.
And, you know, basically just a really, you know, I don't think they spent more than $50 producing that game.
Yeah.
I mean, I could easily come up with that while taking a nap. So I've been playing that for a little bit. What I've been watching TV-wise was the show called Happy Endings. I think Joe, our cohort in arms, suggested it to me. I think you watched it too, Ben.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's a show on ABC. It's like a mid-season replacement. Stars Elijah Dushku and a couple other people.
Yeah. It had a lot of... And the thing I liked about Happy Endings, first of all, this is kind of a back and forth, because I liked that all the relationships were established.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of reminded me of Scrubs, like season 4 to 8, whenever all those characters were like real good friends and like they had dynamics with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in Happy Endings, since it's already established in the pilot, you don't get the relationship building that you would in like Scrubs season 1 to 3,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, where people they're learning about each other and they meet each other for the first time. So, you know, it depends on how you feel about character development. The premise of the movie is that it starts with a wedding. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Starts with a wedding, and some guy in rollerblades walks up and like convinces Elijah. What's her name? Cuthbert.
Yeah,
Cuthbert?
I said Elijah Dushku. Eliza Dushku.
That's not her.
Before,
yeah.
And that's not right at all. It's actually Alicia Cuthbert. My apologies.
Yeah. So she leaves the wedding. She like runs away, and so there's all this back and forth of did she run away with the rollerblade guy, who never makes an appearance again in at least the first and second episode. So I was kind of let down because he actually seemed pretty funny.
Yeah.
And you know, there's all these weird characters and weird situations, and it was fairly entertaining. I was surprised they put 2 episodes on there, but I watched both of them and they were pretty good.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of liked it. And yeah, we should say, like, the kind of thrust of the show is about the people who are involved with the wedding, like the Alicia Cuthbert and the guy, I don't know the actor's name, and all the bridesmaids and all the best men, or the groomsmen, rather, are, like, the central characters of the show. And then when they break up, the show kind of takes place in the aftermath of that, and, like, it's, like, how the group deals with... these two fixtures in their group breaking up and still trying to remain friends with all of them and stuff like that. So that's the kind of main part of the show. Adam Pally is one of the characters. He plays the gay guy on the show. He performs pretty regularly at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater right down the street from my house. So we go and see the kind of free show that they have on Sundays all the time. He is really, really funny. So I'm looking forward to seeing if they'll let him kind of freestyle and improv a little bit. You could tell some of those lines that we've seen in the first 2 episodes of Happy Endings were kind of improv, and they work really well. And I kind of agree with you. I like a lot of the dynamics between the characters, and I'm looking forward to definitely giving this show a little bit more of a shot. You know, I think the pilot and the first couple episodes of any show is not necessarily the greatest representation of the show, because they have to do so much setup and they have to kind of establish everything. So once a little bit of that is out of the way, they can really start finding themselves. I mean, for just look at Parks and Recreation. Like, that show didn't really even come into its own until its second season, and it's like one of my favorite shows on TV now. So
Yeah, I'm totally different. If you're not entertaining me within the first 10 minutes of the pilot, later.
Yeah, I know a lot of people that feel that way, but I thought this was funny enough and kind of charming enough to at least give the benefit of the doubt for at least, I don't know, I'll give it probably 5 episodes or something like that before if it stays exactly the way it is right now, I probably won't watch it, but I'm willing to bet that it'll get a little bit funnier as time goes on. So
the other girl was actually in the last season of Scrubs as or a couple of last seasons of Scrubs as an intern.
Okay.
She kind of became a main character, and she was all right. She was just kind of, serious, funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. She's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, there was one particular plot line in, I think it was the second episode of Happy Endings, that had me cracking up, and it was like when the stereotypical gay guy comes in to like be the best friend, the girl's best friend or whatever, and like they keep making references to like, you know, the Sex in the City kind of archetype of like a gay guy and stuff. I just thought it was hilarious, like the way how over the top and ridiculous that character was. He would just like kick his leg wildly in the air and just like squeal about stuff. I don't know. I found it really funny. It was definitely over the top, but the character did a good job at the very end of that episode, kind of saying, I don't really know if these stereotypes are for me. Like, that's a little bit too much. So at least they kind of address the ridiculousness of what they did, and they realize how crazy it was. So,
ironically enough, Over the Top is the most masculine movie I've ever seen.
There you go, the Sylvester Stallone arm wrestling movie. Are you planning on giving Happy Endings a little bit more of a chance, or you just stop watching it right now?
No, okay, I'll watch a few more episodes.
Okay,
it's only a half hour. It's not like a long, you know, CSI SVU hour long drama or anything.
Right. Okay.
Doesn't really exist.
CSI SVU. It might one of these days. NCIS CSI SVU.
The core.
All right, well, let's go ahead and move on into our review of The Fountain.
Will you deliver Spain from bondage? Take this ring. It is a symbol of your pledge to find the elixir of immortality. You shall wear it when you find Eden. And when you return, I shall be your Eve.
How's she doing?
She had a seizure.
Wait, I'm afraid.
It's been progress of work.
My conquistador, always conquering.
We tested the substance. There's hope.
Your wife needs you.
Because there's a disease. There's a cure. And I will find it.
The Fountain is a movie written and directed by Darren Aronofsky. It was released in 2006. It stars Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz. I've seen this movie. This, I think, was my 6th or 7th viewing of it. I like this movie a lot. What did you think of it, Tyler? Was this your first experience with
Screen it? Screensaver the movie, you mean? Is this what we're talking about here?
Okay, all right.
No, Screensaver the movie?
Clever.
I don't know. It was trippy. It was an Aronofsky movie, I'll tell you that much. I don't know. Maybe you've seen it so many times that you maybe have a fuller understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they were like, I don't know. I was just a lot of times I was just like, wait, what? That was the theme of the movie for me.
Yeah, I can see how it's a little bit confusing, and I've got to be honest, it took me, I think, 2 viewings to really start to appreciate the movie, because the first time I saw it, I was like, WTF, what is that? Like, the movie is not structured, speaking of structure from earlier when we were talking about that Hitchcock movie, there's a lot of time jumping and stuff like that that goes on in here, and a lot of the movie is just kind of repetition of different things through these different stories. So yeah, we should say there are 3 different stories that are going on kind of at the same time. One is set in like the kind of conquistador days back in Spain, and the other one is set in like modern day, and then the other one is like whatever 500 years in the future in this kind of space pod bubble thing. And
spoiler alert.
Basically, the movie I think is just like a really kind of cool meditation on mortality. Like, that's, I mean, that's, those are the main theme. Like, love and mortality are, like, the two things that just come back and forth over and over and over again in this movie. So,
yeah,
I think...
I've written down my notes.
Yeah, so, I don't know, man, like, what, like... You were talking about how it was just kind of confusing. Were there any particular aspects that you liked or didn't like? Like, what was your take on the movie?
Yeah, the one I want to sing the positive. The one thing, and you know, I've kind of looked into stuff like what happens in the afterlife, like purgatory or whatever. And there's some religions that are like, there's this review or this life review you have before you get reincarnated.
Mm-hmm.
So you live multiple lives. And at the end of it, you go to this place, like his bubble, whatever, in space, and you think about what you've done, basically. Meditate, yeah, like you said, you meditate on things. And you go, okay, this is what happened. It basically, it's preparation and meditation for your next life when you go before you go back. So I tried to think of it. I tried to think of it as that, like, conquistador days. You know, he dies and he enters this reincarnation bubble, thinks about it, and then comes back to the modern day. And then maybe it's like some vicious cycle. He's just bouncing back between eras.
Yeah.
Via life review.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of looking at it, because in the very beginning, and, you know, like I said, I've seen this movie a lot of times, and every time I kind of pick up a little bit more and a little bit more, and the movie does a really great job of just kind of giving a feeling, like conveying a feeling that just kind of washes over you as it goes and not necessarily being a very cut and dry thing as far as this is the only interpretation of what can happen of these events. And I think it does kind of leave it open for your own personal experiences and stuff. But I was trying to figure out a little bit of like the chronological points in the movie when I was watching it this time, and I think I noticed in the very beginning, the first time we see Tommy in the space bubble, he eats this, you know, the little piece of the tree, which is kind of supposed to represent Izzy's character, and he says, "I trust you, show me." Like, okay, I trust you, show me. He's like kind of conversing with this spirit, this memory of his wife. And right at that point, that's what leads us into the present, because the opening of the movie is, you know, the whole Mayan thing with like the conquistador time, and then it jumps to the space bubble, and then it goes into the present. So with him saying, "I trust you, show me," and then right after that going directly into the present, I think that's probably a reading that you can have, that kind of afterlife review thing you were talking about, where everything that happens after that point is a kind of living out, like almost like a kind of a Christmas Carol-esque thing, you know, where it's like all of it is just him, Tommy, is sitting back as the audience in his bubble watching what we're seeing and kind of reliving these experiences, or reliving experiences maybe of like ancestors of his, if you want to look at it that way, and just kind of learning this whole lesson about being able to just let go and accept death for what it is. And like, there are some really great dualities and things and kind of conflicts that are raised in this movie, because especially in the present, you know, Izzy is totally, she's got cancer, so she's going to die. And Tommy is a neuroscientist who's working on a cure for brain tumors and stuff. And he's constantly just like staying at work all the time and like trying to really go hard and find a cure for her disease. And she has just accepted death and is looking at all these things, kind of like you're mentioning, Tyler, these other religions and all these different views about what happens after you die and stuff. And she's really kind of looking at it in kind of a positive light, and looking at it in this version of like rebirth and stuff like that. These kind of positive and like interpretations of death, basically. And he is just seeing everything as a negative, that he just won't have her anymore. So in a way,
the real struggle, I thought, was him struggling between trying to find the cure and spending enough time and saying goodbye to her.
Yeah.
Spending time with her, because he's like conflicted between spending time with her and hanging out and being happy and whatever, versus finding a cure so that what he thinks happiness is will last longer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like he's constant, and that's why I think he's so messed up, is because, you know, he was trying to choose one to get one, but then he needed the other one to get this, and it all kind of blew up in his face. But then again, of course, it goes on to end.
Yeah, and I think what you just said is absolutely right. Like, what he thinks is happiness will go on for him. So in a way, the movie's like, Tommy, the character, is really selfish because he's not like supportive of his.
Well, he's learning. Like, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Like, the whole point of the reincarnation, apparently, from what I've read, mm-hmm. is that you learn over the course of your lives. So the mistakes you make in one life, you remember in your next lives, so that you can correct them. Like, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie, when she walks out into the snow, she wants him to go on a walk with her.
Mm-hmm.
In the first couple scenes, or the first couple lives, whatever, you know, he doesn't go with her. He goes into surgery. And then, and then in the next later scenes, or the later lives, he follows her out instead of going to surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a self-correction.
Yeah, no, he's totally, yeah, and you're right. You're absolutely right. And by the end of the movie, he does come to grips with the fact that he's going to have to let her go. And he does kind of plant that little seed in, like, yeah, right next to her grave and stuff, which is, you know, that's like, she goes to that museum in that one scene right before she has the seizure, and is like pointing out this Mayan book where it shows First Father like with this tree that kind of has sprouted out from him, and like talks about this in another scene. I think she talks about she went on a trip to South America and you know, had this kind of Mayan guy that was there telling her about his grandfather or something, and like how you become one with nature when you die, and like if you tried to dig up his body, it wouldn't be there because he's grown into a tree, which is grown into a fruit off the tree, and when a bird eats that, he's kind of flying through the air and all this kind of stuff. And like those are the lessons that the character of Tommy in the quote-unquote present day has to learn by the end of the movie, is that, you know, it's not just life doesn't just end like that. And I think, you know, they keep talking about being together forever, and the only way that that's really going to happen is when Tommy stops searching for a cure for death, which is what he just gets obsessed with, and realizes that he's probably going to die someday too, or is going to die someday too, and that's when he's really going to be kind of reunited with Izzy.
Yeah, he reaches nirvana.
Yeah. What did you think of the depiction of the three different time periods?
Yeah, it was muddled, but I think that was the whole point. You know, there were times where they would just flip back and forth for no reason whatsoever. But yeah, it was fairly well done. I knew what time period was which and all that stuff.
Yeah.
What
did you think about like the specific looks of each of the different times?
Oh, I thought the Conquistador, I thought that would have made a good movie on its own, like,
yeah,
without all that stuff, like the period piece or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like I said, screensaver of the movie, that basically explains the bubble,
yeah,
area, that time period with him in the tree. And then the modern time period, I think the lighting could have been a little better. It was fairly dark, hard to see certain things. It was, I think a little more light could have been useful, but okay. As far as like set design and stuff, I thought it was all right.
Yeah.
Nothing to complain about.
Yeah.
The house was kind of weird that they lived in. I didn't know. I don't think they even showed an exterior of the house.
No, they didn't. They didn't.
So I don't know where they were living. It was just kind of a weird castle.
Yeah.
I assume.
And
it was the cool thing was when he drove to the hospital, like the camera was upside down,
yeah,
and then it flipped over as the car goes towards the city, and then they do the same thing again in the Spanish time where the horse was going, and they flip the camera again, and the horse was going towards the,
yeah,
a castle or a temple or something like that.
Yeah, and then they do it again with the space bubble on the way to Chipola.
Yeah, I couldn't tell with that one. It was hard because space and time, man.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said that the lighting could have been a little better, because I think this is like some of the best lighting of any movie that I've ever seen, just from the way that the lighting kind of highlights the production design and makes it better. Like through the Spanish scene when he goes to meet with the queen, and you know, she requests that private meeting right after he like doesn't assassinate that guy, for the Inquisitor. He's walking through this area, and there's like hanging candles and stuff all in that whole region, you know what I'm talking about, in that big room. And like, it, they use mirrors to make it seem like it just goes on forever. They just clearly like stacked mirrors on one side of the walkway and on the other, so it kind of extends out and just makes it feel like it's going on forever. I think that's probably like, so that's one example of the lighting. And the other thing that I was actually reading about this movie recently is that that's like a choice that Aronofsky made on purpose. Was he wanted it to be kind of a darker movie in the very beginning, and then as the movie progressed, have the light increase in all of the different timelines that are going on to show Tommy's kind of journey towards enlightenment, basically. So it's like a stylistic thing that he made. So as the movie went on, it did get a little brighter in each of the three worlds or whatever.
Gotcha.
But
Nirvana.
Yeah, and I think like this movie is kind of interesting. I'm really surprised that Warner Brothers would actually finance a movie like this, because it's kind of a hard sell. You know, this is not like,
yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It's not an easily described movie. And you know, Aronofsky, he made Requiem for a Dream right before this in the year 2000. He made Pi right before that. That was his debut. So he wasn't necessarily like a quote unquote proven filmmaker at the time. And some might say even now he's not necessarily like a proven filmmaker. Sure, he did The Wrestler and Black Swan recently, and those are a little bit more kind of critically acclaimed and also commercially successful. But The Fountain, I think, is one that is overlooked a lot in Aronofsky's resume. And it's because I think it had kind of a troubled production history. It was actually supposed to be made for $70 million, and Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett were supposed to be the leads in the movie. They developed the film for like a couple of years, I think, and then Brad Pitt wanted to like make some notes on the script and kind of add or take away, make some changes and stuff, and they didn't do it, so he dropped out of the project, and they had to wait on Cate Blanchett, who was going to be having a child, and so they waited for her to have a kid, and then by that time they were going to start like a year after that, and by that time he was gone. So Warner Brothers kind of pulled the plug on the movie. And it just wasn't going to get made anymore. They had already done like a couple years worth of pre-production and stuff. They had built like a 10-story Mayan temple that just got auctioned off because the movie just stopped. Like, they just weren't going to make it anymore. So Aronofsky went off to try to go and write some other things and look to develop some other movies and stuff. And eventually he just kept coming back to The Fountain, and he ended up rewriting some of the movie to like make kind of a no budget version of it. So, and like, he just cut out a lot of the bigger sequences and stuff and concentrated more on the characters, I think, from what I understand. So he got it back into production by telling them he would cut the budget from $70 million to $35 million. So that's like a huge thing, a huge cut. I mean, more than half. And, or I guess it's like, right.
It's exactly
half. Yeah. Sorry. I'm terrible at math. So, yeah, I mean, cutting the budget in half, like, that's got to look good for a studio to be like, okay, fine, we'll still have this thing. And then he got Hugh Jackman to come on and take over Brad Pitt's role. And Hugh Jackman actually was the one who kind of lobbied for Rachel Weisz to get the part, because Darren Aronofsky was actually romantically involved with Rachel Weisz at the time. That's no longer the case. But he kind of hesitated on casting her because he didn't want it to look like he was playing favorites or something. But Hugh Jackman was really the one who kind of went to bat for Rachel Weisz and got her onto the movie. So, you know, there's kind of like an interesting history with how much time they had put into this movie already, and then eventually kind of the version that we got, which is a lot more streamlined. And like the cinematographer, Matthew Liebetick, or I think that's how you pronounce his name, he's shot I think all of Aronofsky's films. He also shot Iron Man, the Favreau movie. He kind of has said, and Aronofsky himself has also said in recent years, like, the way that they cut the movie down definitely made for a better film. It's, you know, it's helped them tell the story more efficiently, I guess. So I think there was
possibly effectively as well.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. And
efficient and effective.
Right. And I think like the way that they used the visual effects, especially that kind of screensaver thing that you keep referring to, that whole futuristic time, is really awesome. They use like macro photography, and they hired on this guy, I think, what is his name? His name is Peter Parks, a specialist in macro photography, and he like just shot all these really, really up close things of like organisms reacting to each other and chemicals and bacteria and all this stuff, and got these super up close things, and that's what they used in the background for space and all of those kind of Shabulba shots and all that kind of stuff. So I think the movie turned out really well for, you know, essentially a movie that was supposed to be made for double the amount of money. I'm glad that we have the version that we do now, basically, because I'm a really big fan of this film. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention, Tyler?
I have a couple notes.
Yeah, go for it.
Was there anything else you wanted to go over?
I mean, I've got a couple things written down, but it's all just like stuff that I've noticed because this is what, like my sixth or seventh viewing or something. Right. So I'll bring those up in just like bullet point form a little bit later, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to do my bullet point right now.
Okay.
First of all, she's unbreakable, i.e. Bruce Willis, because she can't feel anything.
Okay. Cancer, it makes you unbreakable.
I didn't know it was cancer up till that point.
Yeah.
Bathtub scene. All right, now who's going to clean this up and don't use your new disease to get out of it? Because all the water spills over and just goes all over the floor.
Wow.
Seriously, no one ever thinks about that. Next bullet point. It's a monkey. I thought they were worried about Donovan was a person, but it's actually a monkey. Why start Planet of the Apes sooner than you have to?
Yeah, actually,
although I don't promote animal cruelty at all.
That's funny because a new trailer just came out for a movie called Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is a prequel to Planet of the Apes, and it stars James Franco and Andy Serkis, who plays Gollum in Lord of the Rings, and he's doing like motion capture stuff for this movie, and it kind of the scenes in the trailer for Rise of the Planet of the Apes do resemble the scenes in The Fountain where they're doing operations on Donovan and stuff like that. So it's funny you bring that up.
But the movies in the Planet of the Apes series are prequels to Planet of the Apes. If you go back and watch like all five movies, like it's a circular series. Like the last three movies, I think, are building up to what will be Planet of the Apes, the first movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Bram Stoker's Dracula came to mind in a lot of scenes, especially with that, you know, kind of dark medieval middle age scenes and like praying in front of the cross. And then Van Helsing, of course, came to mind because he grabbed a crossbow and it's Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
Do your job! Exclamation point. A lot of those people at the hospital, he's like, okay, prep the next patient. And they're like,
yeah,
and they'll like stare at him, and they're like, "Okay, you're the nurse. He's the doctor. Do what he says." Quit huffing and puffing. And then the quote, "I already work around the clock." Harrison Ford quote from that Fraser movie came to mind as well.
Yeah,
"I already work around the clock."
Yes, Extraordinary Measures is the name of that film.
Yes. And then I realized that she's the tree.
Yes.
Which I guess I was a little late to the party on that one because I didn't figure that out until way past halfway.
Okay. Yeah.
I thought that was a tree. I thought that was like the tree of life, and he was going to see her in space.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the case.
Yeah. There's a couple like little clues along the way that on repeat viewings it makes it a little bit more clear that distinction is actually there. Tommy in space at one point kind of rubs his hand over the bark of the tree, and then it transitions into a shot of him rubbing like her back or something while he's in that bathtub scene. Yeah.
The other thing I want to bring up was like the idea of Nirvana, which I believe he reaches at the end of the movie in reincarnation. Like you go back, and depending on what you did in your life, like if you did bad things, you go back down lower, like an animal or a ghost or something, or you end up in hell.
Right.
But if you do good things, you go higher and higher, and eventually you reach nirvana and you get out of the reincarnation system.
Mm-hmm.
So you stop being born again. You just go into wherever, nirvana. And I think that's kind of what happened.
Okay, cool.
And that's my final thought.
Nice. Yeah, there's just a couple things that I noticed a little bit. And, you know, like I said, because I've seen it so many times, like I think the space, like that whole time thing, that whole prong of the movie is actually the future of Tommy from the present. Like, I think he was talking about a way of like fighting death and stuff, like, you know, looking for a cure for death. And I think it's kind of implied, a reading of this movie that you could have is that Tommy actually finds the cure for death, because it also implies, like, right after Izzy dies, the doctor woman, Tommy's boss, comes in and says, oh yeah, it works, the tumor is going into remission or whatever, like Donovan is okay now, and, you know, which is ironic because Izzy just died, and like that's obviously what he was kind of working toward.
Oh no!
Yeah, bad timing there. But I think, you know, you can kind of extrapolate from that. If Tommy could find a cure for cancer, maybe if he kind of applied himself with that same kind of rigor to finding a cure for death, then maybe he did, and maybe the him floating through space is actually the same guy who has. You know, like with the tattoos and stuff, how he's constantly like inking on himself, and he's actually got that real, the same tattoo around where his wedding band would be, and then like all these other tattoos all around his arms and stuff that he has in the future in the space bubble. It could be the same actual person instead of just like an ancestor or something like that, I think. So
yeah, they're hashtags on how long he's been there.
Yeah, but we don't know like really how long that actually could have taken or how long it would have taken. That's not really described in the movie, but I think it could be like a version that you could read the movie is that is actually the same guy, because I noticed this time around he said all these years, all these memories, like he actually uttered those words right in the space bubble. So I feel like maybe that's actually a true thing. And then also kind of going back to what I said in the very beginning, how he says, I trust you, show me, and maybe like he's just kind of letting her like opening his mind to all these memories of how things played out in those last days of Izzy's life. So that just kind of popped into my head. And then also another visual motif. I mean, there's a lot of visual stuff that goes on in this movie. It's an Aronofsky film, clearly, so he's like all about that. But lines versus circles, I think there are, and this is getting like super ridiculous with like the specificity of reading this film, but I just wanted to bring it up anyway. Lines, I think, could equal death, because, you know, life is kind of linear, and there's a beginning, there's an end, it's over. And like anytime lines appear in this movie, especially in that present time when Tommy is looking through her hospital room, for example, there's all these lines that are going horizontally on the door, and it shows his eyes looking through the kind of slit in the wall, you know? And so like that's where anytime death is like prominently featured in the film, I feel like there are a lot of there's a lot of line imagery, and then circles as, you know, kind of hope and her and Izzy's representation and kind of interpretation of what happens after you die, and this kind of circle of life and rebirth and all these things. There's a lot of circular imagery that comes up in the film too, and I think those are in the more kind of hopeful moments of the movie. So that's another thing that I just kind of took notice of on this most recent viewing. There wasn't really anything else that I had in my notes. So if that's it for you, let's go ahead and just do some kind of final thoughts on it. Oh yeah, sorry. You go ahead.
You usually catch it right away. This time you didn't. yeah, it's a movie that you're gonna think about. So if you don't want to think really hard, I wouldn't suggest it. But you know, if you're into eschatology or the afterlife or meditation or philosophy or any of that stuff, this would probably be a pretty intense movie to check out.
Yeah, I think it's
so
worth
tread at your own risk.
I think it's worth seeing visually alone. You know, this is one of those things that you can just have on in the background And it's just kind of a beautiful movie to see, because the way that they use that macro photography is unlike anything that I've ever seen before, especially with those space scenes and stuff. I think this movie does a better job at kind of conjuring a feeling than it does at actually being a like a cohesive story. Because, I mean, as you can tell with the, you know, we just spent however long, 20, 30 minutes talking about like a version of how this movie might have played out, because it's so, it's all kind of unclear and nebulous. You know, don't really know exactly when things are happening or if they were happening to the same person the whole time or whatever. So, if you're looking for like, if you're the type of moviegoer that, needs closure in that way of very specific things, then you'll probably be a little bit, uneasy, I guess, when this movie ends, because it doesn't answer all of those questions directly. But I think if you like movies like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and a little bit more kind of cerebral dramas, then this is a pretty fantastic film. I like it a lot. So
that's a weird genre.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and kick on the Apple II and see what we're going to be watching. Actually, we should make an announcement
quickly.
We're not going to be recording next week because next week is Easter, and we may or may not be recording the week after that. But the next
time, I'll be busy looking for Nirvana.
Right. The next time that we record, let's see what the Apple II has got in store for us.
All right, let's pull that lever. Oh, Ben.
Yes.
I hope you like franchise movies.
It depends on the franchise. What do we got?
I wish I could have thought of another franchise right off the bat to curveball at you, but no. The Muppets, have you heard of these guys?
Yes, I have heard of these people. Yeah.
So we're going to try to watch a couple of the early ones with Jim Henson, you know, on deck. I guess the Muppet movie. The Great Muppet Caper and Muppets Take Manhattan.
Wow, a triple feature. All right, Apple II.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
There we go. All right, well, that'll actually work out pretty well considering we're not going to be recording next week, so that'll give everybody a little bit of time.
But if I reach Nirvana, I won't be attending, so sorry.
All right, I'll keep that in mind.
And some letters with my blood ink.
Okay. Yeah, so The Muppet Movie, The Muppets Take Manhattan, and The Great Muppet Caper, right?
That's what the Apple II is telling me.
All right, cool. Well, feel free to check those
Peter,
out.
Kermit the Frog here.
That's going to be awesome. All right, cool. I'm looking forward
to
that. So
episode one all over again.
Yeah. he's referencing all of the Batman films that we watched. So go back and listen to that episode if you guys are fans of this podcast and haven't heard that one yet.
2 hours long.
Yeah, it is. It's a good one, though. So as far as, yeah, if you guys want to check those out, you can send us an email at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of those three Muppet films. Leave Muppets from Space and Muppet Treasure Island out of it. We don't want anything to do with those.
And Muppet Christmas Carol and Muppet Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, we don't need those. Just keep your thoughts on
and
those.
And Muppet Star Wars.
I think that one's fake.
But Eat, Pray, Love.
Eat, Pray, Muppets.
Eat, Pray, Muppets.
So you guys can also call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 and let us know what you think of those films. Can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Leave us a review. That'd be awesome. You can check us out on Facebook. And we are on Twitter, twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. We have two new followers this week, at MovieVine and at Thirtea, which is Thirtea. So thanks for the follows there, guys. Appreciate it. Yes.
The Muppet in the Iron Mask.
Ooh, you're still going off of Muppet titles. I think
Three Muppeteers.
The Muppeteers, man. Yeah, you should turn that into a hashtag thing on Twitter and just come up with random Muppet.
Brokeback Muppet.
There you go. That's one. And just hashtag it Muppet Movie or Muppet Movies or something. And just like you could spend a week coming up with those things.
North by North Muppet.
All right, that makes no sense. But all right.
It happened one Muppet.
This could get really out of hand.
It happened at the World's Muppet.
Oh, man. All right. Well, Shaun of the Muppet. Let's go ahead. and finish up the character
the
name game.
Muppet
so
Mandments.
The Muppet what? I haven't heard that one. What did you say?
The Ten Muppet Mandments, but that was a little too edgy for this show. I'm gonna keep that on the underground.
Yeah. All right, so let's go back to the character name game, finish that up for this week. What was the name again?
The character name game for this week is Melissa Robinson.
Melissa Robinson. All right. I'm going to say The Princess Diaries.
Ooh. Interesting choice, but no, that's incorrect.
Okay. All right.
But you may or may not be on the right track.
Those of you who are guessing along for the first time, we should mention that the movie has to have at least some sort of tie to a film that was released in wide release this past Friday. So that
at least be, 6 steps.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Tyler takes that a little bit further than I do. That would be Rio, Scream 4, and The Conspirator are the only main movies that open this week.
Oh,
and
since
Tyler has a predilection for Anne Hathaway, I was assuming The Princess Diaries, but clearly that's wrong for the first guess. All right, so how about
still, she will not return my Twitter messages.
Melissa Robinson, how about... It's just such a generic name. I feel like that could be anything. How about... what is that movie? Remember the Titans.
Ooh. Incorrect.
Okay, all right.
Although, Remember the Muppets would be a good one, too.
All right, you want to give me some sort of hints?
Not really.
Okay.
And okay. I will. What kind of hint do you want?
Director, a year, something like
that. All right, I'll give you a director.
Okay.
Tom Shadyac.
Tom Shadyac.
I don't know what that means to you.
Oh, I know what this is, actually. It is Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, right?
Correct.
Okay, awesome. Yeah.
Who's Melissa Robinson?
That's Courtney Cox's character in that movie, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was going to pick Ray Finkel, but I think that would have given it away.
Finkel and Einhorn. Yes.
I'm in Psychoville, Florida, and Ray Finkel's the mayor.
Oh, man. What a great movie. Okay. Nicely done. And obviously, you want to tell people the connection?
Melissa Robinson is played by Courtney Cox, and Courtney Cox is in Scream 4.
There you go. Nice.
Or Scriforum, as other people are calling it.
Right. Since the 4 is embedded as the A in the movie for some reason.
Sure, because that's the thing nowadays, replacing letters with numbers, so we're just going to have a binary-based language
yeah.
in 10 to 15 years.
Yeah. All right.
10011, the sequel.
Yeah. Oh, man. And yeah, you can't really add the number 2 in there because that's not how binary works.
It's not binary. It's not a binary character. Duh.
All right. Well, let's go back and forth and just.
Made up of 011.
Let's tell people where they can find more of our work online this week on the internet. So, Tyler, let's start with you.
You can find me at the Solar Sentinel on Destageddon, and I run very poorly the Not Just New Movie Twitter account.
Okay, well,
if you're talking to the Not Just New Movie podcast, you're talking to me.
Yeah, keep your eyes peeled for a potential Muppet movie hashtag influx of ridiculous movie titles involving Muppets there.
And I'm going to address them to at Jim Henson, hopefully, Twitter from the afterlife.
Yeah, that would be awesome. All right, from Nirvana, maybe.
He's reached enlightenment.
Ooh, man.
Hashtag.
On fire.
I meant.
All right, well, you guys can track me down on Twitter at twitter.com/BenPears. You can find me writing at geektyrant.com, filmonic.com, notjustnewmovies.com, the namesake for this podcast, and you can find me also on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast. Music for our show is provided by George Turner and the Bandits. You can find their music at gtbandits.com, and they are also on Twitter and Facebook, so check them out there. Again, we're taking next week off due to Easter Sunday, but keep your iTunes or whatever method you find this, keep your eyes
iPad news.
Yeah, for our massive Muppet podcast upcoming Muppet movie, The Muppets Take Manhattan and The Great Muppet Caper. So
it just sounds ridiculous when you say it like that.
It does, but it's going to be a lot of fun. I
The Great Muppet Opus is what we should call that episode.
Nice. Okay, done. That's all we need.
I didn't know, folks.
All right, well, cool. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will see you guys next time. Everybody have a good Easter weekend.
Salute.
all the money that I